50-50. Perhaps it was true, and perhaps not, that the wives of American GIs had been given special training in how to welcome their husbands home from the war. It might have been the Korean War, or maybe the Second World War. Each wife had been told to wear a dress her husband had seen her in before he left, to have the same hairstyle and color, and not to change anything in the house. They had even suggested that one way of allowing young children to remember their father would be to make a life-sized cardboard cutout of him, standing in the upstairs hallway, so that the children could say, "Hi, Daddy," and "Bye, Daddy," as they went in and out of the bathroom on their way to bed at night and to school in the morning. Anyway, the person who told her this thought it was true. When her own brother died at 50 of cancer, she remembered these suggestions from the Defense Department and had to convince herself that the original suggestions were designed for families which were going to be reunited, not for families which would never see one another again. Even so, she thought about making a life-size cutout of her brother to place on the stairs or near the back door so she could just blow him the odd kiss in passing or tell him her latest secret. In the end, she dropped the idea. It would be foolish to call attention to her mourning for her brother by creating a cartoon out of a tragedy. Anyway, it wasn't a tragedy to anyone else who might come to her house. Her brother died abroad, and none of her friends had ever met him. Her own children had met him only twice. They certainly didn't miss him or have any need to speak to him on a regular basis. Instead, she put a quite average-sized photograph of him just outside one of the doors to the kitchen, the one which led to the back hallway and the back door. It was a completely ordinary picture and looked like any other family snapshot, even though it had been taken by a photographer. A series of casual shots had been done just before he was appointed head of the Colorado State Welfare Department. There he was, smiling, a good-looking guy with his jacket casually slung over one shoulder. The ritual she had developed over the few years since his death was so minimal, she felt certain it was not obvious to anyone else in the house. Her children had never noticed, and no guest had ever commented. The layout of the house provided the perfect cover for her fleeting one-to-one visits with her brother. In particular, at the bottom of the stairs, a person heading to the kitchen could choose either the short route by turning left or the slightly longer route by turning right. The children always turned left. By turning right, she backtracked along the staircase and walked under the landing where the photo of her brother hung. Each morning, her eyes met his briefly. That's all. There was nothing spooky about it. She almost never blew any kisses and hardly ever spoke. Anyone turning left at the bottom of the stairs would get to the kitchen quicker, and she was pleased to let them arrive first and get on with their breakfast putterings with the kettle and the toast. She had devised a simple schedule for her long-term interactions with her brother. Well, actions is a more accurate word. She was never under any illusion that he would speak back to her. No, total sanity and a full grasp of reality always prevailed during these snippets of communication. It was a 50-year plan in which each day she would go over some tiny bit of their childhood with him, allowing him a minute window of responding opportunity. Usually, she had already entered the kitchen by the time even a fully alive person could have responded, but her brother's condition and the need to be fairly secretive with others in the house meant there was no actual other halves of these interactions. If she were to be totally honest with herself, she would admit that most of her exchanges with her brother were really with herself. This seemed to her absolutely fine. It was not a compromise, it was a solution. Yes, even though 50 years was a rather optimistic time span to aim for, 30 would have been more realistic, but she liked the symmetry of it, 50 years of his life and 50 years of hers. Currently, she had been replaying a particular childhood story with him, just a small portion of the story every day. It was not one of her favorites and was taking a long time. Some of the simpler stories, usually the ones she preferred, could be dealt with in 1 or 2 weeks by processing them a few seconds at a time. For instance, she liked the one about the cigar bands the family doctor used to give her and her brother when he made house calls. The two of them would slip the red and gold bands onto their busy little fingers. Of course, this was the olden days when smoking was thought to be a kind of character enhancer. This particular story took just 1 week. But the one about wetting the bed usually took at least 4 weeks, 4 rather painful weeks. The current story had been playing for over 2 months, and still there was no end in view. She began to question the value of her original plan. The story was the one about their father's left index finger. She knew 2 versions of the beginning of the story and was having trouble settling on one or the other. Trying to decide took time. The first version was how it had unfolded to her as a child, and the second was the version she had heard later, events described in the order in which they had actually occurred. Originally, the story began when her brother said to her, "Mommy and Daddy won't be able to pick us up from camp this summer because Daddy hurt his finger. We'll have to take the train to Grand Central Station." It wasn't hard to follow. All the facts were there, and even the instructions for what they were to do. So they got on the train with other children from the camp. It was the only summer they ever took the train. Counselors from the camp helped all the children get on the right trains and get off at the right time. It was not difficult or scary, but it was very out of character for their parents. She knew it, and her brother knew it. After all, their family had a car, and their parents enjoyed driving up to New England. She could sense that something was not quite right. Once on the train, after settling down to comic books and bubble gum, her brother said to her, "Laurie, Mum asked me to tell you something after we got on the train. She didn't want to tell you on the phone in case you started to cry, so I'm supposed to tell you now. Daddy didn't just hurt his finger a little bit. He was using the bench saw. He actually cut it off, right off. But they sewed it back on, and that's why they couldn't come get us." "Off" is the word that stuck in her mind. It still sticks in her mind, and it is one of the words which is continually exchanged between her and her brother, morning after morning, during their brief sharing times at the back door of the kitchen, under the landing. The other way to play the story is how it actually happened. This version includes the accident itself, a kitchen towel, a bath towel, blood, a bench saw, and the barking dog. The dog's name was Champ. Their father never liked the dog, and the fact that Champ became so rambunctious at the time of the accident was one of the most disturbing parts of this version of the story. It goes on to include the conversation their mother had with her brother and did not have with her. Most of the pieces of this story, as well as the other story, were in pretty good order after having been told for several years now. The part which is still being pieced together is the part in which their mother speaks. "Don't tell Laura yet." Sometimes the word "yet" would make her feel almost dizzy with the pain of being kept out of a secret. Other times, the words "don't tell" were the ones which hurt most. She was the second child and had often felt that her mother and brother knew things which were withheld from her. She was always too young. This morning, she entered the kitchen and took her place among the breakfast makers, waiting for her son to put the kettle down. She thought about all the accidents the kitchen could unleash on her and her children, accidents which could then later impact on their lives. Her daughter's short fingers fished around in the toaster for a small piece of charred toast, which probably shrank during toasting. She looked out the back window, catching a glimpse of the two houses behind their house, and she looked along the passageway walled between them. Then she thought of the platforms between the trains at Grand Central Station. She and her brother were holding hands, turning left at the top of the ramp, following the crowd, not really knowing anything about how railroad stations were laid out. How would anyone know where they were, dwarfed in this great maze of steel tracks and grimy platforms? How would their parents ever find them? Huge billboards and posters were on either side of them, as if they were carried along by the crowd. None of the faces or products in the posters were at all familiar. She hadn't even begun to arrange her breakfast things this morning. Instead, she went back to the hallway by the door she had entered. She left the kitchen on the pretext of checking that her keys were ready for her to take with her. Of course, she looked up. Then she picked up the keys and jingled them to prove that her retreat had a purpose.